I'm Jordan Abel, Director of Public Programs at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco, and I welcome you to Bina, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the JCCSF. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. On this edition of Bina, we feature two topics from the JCCSF Foodways series, where we focus on the ingredients we use and on some of the people who grow and produce them. In the first half of the hour, our guest is James Beard Award-winning writer Rowan Jacobson, who writes on food and the environment and the intersection of the two. Then, in the second half of the hour, our guest is farmer, community organizer, and environmental justice advocate Kristen Leach from Namu Farm. She's joined in conversation by writer and food activist Shakira Simley. And now, join Lenore Naxon on stage at the JCCSF as she introduces Rowan Jacobson.
Good evening, everyone. My name is Lenore Naxon. I'm part of the Arts and Ideas team here at the JCC. If you can't tell by my accent, I'm originally from Chicago, where apple harvest signals the chill in the air, cinnamon sticks in warm cider, and a plethora of beautiful Midwest varietals. Well, I've been in San Francisco for a long time and found that even though here September means summer, it also means an extraordinary array of splendid, locally grown apples. I always look forward to this time of year to the delight of dipping tart pippins and Granny Smiths in honey for Rosh Hashanah. Rowan just told me he's been asked to do some apple and honey pairings for Rosh Hashanah this year, something that I hadn't thought of before. And it's the wonderful opportunity to take big, crunchy bites of beautiful, sweet apples that abound at Byright and all the other local Marcos. So it's just fitting that we start our fall season with a celebration of apples and with Rowan Jacobson. His love affair with apples began when he bought an old farmhouse in Vermont and discovered the mysterious old apple trees on the property. Soon he was making his own hard cider and learning that there was far more to the fruit with the great range than we would ever learn from what we find in a supermarket. Apples of Uncommon Character is his celebration of the incredible diversity and utility, Malus domestica, a two-time James Beard Award winner and perennial presence in the Best Food Writing Anthology. He writes for Orion, Mother Jones, Harper's, Outside, Yankee, and many other publications. His other books include A Geography of Oysters, Fruitless Fall, and American Terroir. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Rowan Jacobson.
Thanks, everyone. Thanks for coming out on a Monday night. And also, that was an amazing spread of apples out there. That was really a treat to see that. Did anyone try the Ash Beans Kernel? Isn't that a fantastic apple? That is the taste right there of Southern England circa 1700. That was when that apple was first discovered. And they went wild for it 300 years ago. So that is exactly, when you taste that, you're tasting exactly what the English apple geeks were excited about 300 years ago. So it's kind of fun to make that connection. So favorites, what did you have out there that you liked? Just shout it out.
Hawaiian.
I've never seen that apple before. That's new for me out here.
Sweet surprise.
The pink surprise? That's the pink surprise, yeah. For anyone who didn't, afterward, take a look. It's really fun to surprise people with those because it looks like a regular green apple on the outside and you let someone take a bite out of it and it's like something out of a fairy tale, you know? It's like bright pink inside. And
Honeycrisp.
As I call it, the 800-pound gorilla in the apple industry right now. Jonathan, one of the all-time classics, considered one of the greatest tasting apples that America ever produced. Used in a lot of breeding programs because it's got that really distinctive apple flavor.
The lonely
Gravenstein. Yeah, I was waiting for a Gravenstein vote there. I was surprised to... I guess that actually is a kind of is the point I wanted to talk about tonight, and part of the reason I wrote my book is because when I started learning about apples, and especially some of the heirlooms, but also the modern varieties, maybe 10 to 12 years ago, I was amazed at this incredible diversity that was out there that I really had not known about. Being a normal kid growing up in the 70s, I was Red Delicious, Golden Delicious. Then Granny Smith came along and was the wild and crazy apple in the room. And in New England, we had Macintosh too, but that was about it. Winesap's a big, big apple in the South. The apple that kind of saved the South back in the 1700s and then came out here and started the industry in the West Coast and then got replaced by, you know who? Red Delicious. The Red Delicious is kind of like the fall guy in my story. And actually, somebody mentioned Gala out there, and I was having dinner with some of the big mega apple growers up in Washington State a few days ago, and they told me that we are kind of at a watershed moment, that they think this is actually going to be the year when Red Delicious, after ruling the roost since the 1950s, at least, gets passed and is no longer the number one sold apple in the country by Gala. So here's to Gala. Okay, so I guess my point is that the apple is this incredible entity that has this incredibly wide range, and we haven't been asking enough of it. It can do a lot of different things. It's almost like if you had Robin Williams on your ensemble cast and you told him just be the straight man, right? Don't do any voices. The apple can do all kinds of voices, and it's really entertaining when it does. So I'll talk a little bit about some of the voices it can do. It can be mysterious. It can be adorable. It can be classy. It can be sexy. It can be surprising, like that pink surprise. And it can be downright freaky. Our ancestors 200 years ago would have totally known that the apple could be all kinds of different things, because they actually depended on it to be all kinds of different things. Right from the early colonial days, the apple was partnering with the colonists to make life on farms a whole lot sweeter than it would have been otherwise. Not only was it for fresh fruit, which is what we tend to associate it with, and for baking, but it also gave them a source of fruit throughout the year. There were certain apples that would come ripe in June and July, and there were other apples that you would pick them off the tree in November, hard as a rock. There's no way you could have eaten them. They were so sour at the time. But you put them in your root cellar for 3-4 months and took them out in the spring, and they would have just started to mellow up and become really nice and develop some interesting flavors that you wouldn't taste normally in a fresh apple. So they really gave them a source of fruit throughout the year. But even more than that, they also gave them a way to get drunk throughout the year, because the apple, until corn really came along and was grown in significant quantities and beer came along with that, the apple was, cider was the standard tipple for everybody, man, woman, and child. It was low alcohol, maybe 4% alcohol, and safer than the water, and that was what everybody drank. Also, another one that people don't think about is vinegar. Cider vinegar was a really important preservative back in the days pre-refrigeration. So the apple could be all kinds of different things, and a typical homestead would have grown probably a dozen varieties. And every region of the country would have had different varieties. So there's an incredible, incredible range of apples, but there were no national apples back then. As you travel around the country, each town would have its own specialty apples that it was famous for. And it was so you would really get a distinct flavor of the place through its apples wherever you went. And there's actually, I found this great quote by Henry Ward Beecher, who was the abolitionist minister back around Civil War days, who also was famous for his appetite and wrote a great essay about apple pie, which is well worth reading. It's really fun. And he described a typical New York cellar from the 1860s, which it's really striking how it makes you realize that people really knew what to do with apples back in the day. I'll go ahead and read it. On the east side stood a row of cider barrels, for 12 or 20 barrels of cider were a fit provision for the year, And what was not consumed for drink was expected duly to turn into vinegar, and was then exalted to certain hogsheads kept for the purpose. But along the middle of the cellar were the apple bins, and when the season had been propitious, there were stores and heaps of russets, greenings, seek-no-furthers, pearmains, gilliflowers, spitzenbergs, and many besides, nameless but not virtuous. All those varieties are still with us today, actually. And to understand where all that diversity comes from, we have to talk a little bit about the birds and the bees. Chiefly the bees, in this case. Because the important fact to understand about apples is that apples do not come true from seed. If you take a seed out of a Red Delicious and plant it, the tree that grows up will not have Red Delicious fruit. It'll have a different type of fruit than has ever existed before, because that seed is a genetically unique individual. Half its genes from its mother tree and half from its father, who was passed along through the pollen via a bee. So just like we are, you know, we aren't identical to our parents, but we're a mix of the two things. True for an apple, but apples are very different than us. They have a lot of recessive traits, a lot of buried traits, so they tend to not resemble their parents remotely. It's almost like if you had two full houses in a card deck and you put them together and shuffled them and turned out cards randomly, you wouldn't probably have an interesting hand at all. You wouldn't have a hand that was like the other hand. Apples are like that. Their genes are just shuffled so much with every seed that something totally new will come into being. And what happened in the colonies is that the settlers didn't have wherewithal for trees. They couldn't carry trees with them on their journeys as they were settling the frontier. They carried seeds. So this amazing genetic experiment took place with thousands or even hundreds of thousands of farmers planting millions of apple seeds, most famously Johnny Appleseed. And all those trees were potentially new varieties of apples. Most of them were not very good. They were just sour green apples, and they'd go straight to the pigs or the fermentation barrel. But every now and then, 1 out of 100 or 1 out of 1,000 was something special. And when that happened, people would recognize it, and they would take cuttings of it and graft it onto a rootstock so that it was genetically identical, and then you had a new variety. They'd name it after the farmer who found it, and that's how all varieties have come into existence until breeding programs more recently. So when the apple hit America, it partnered with the colonists to create this amazing genetic experiment. And you never knew what you were going to get. But every single one was potentially the new Honeycrisp. And in fact, since they're still in the old cellar holes and dirt roads of America, tons and tons of wild apple trees that have sprung up, undoubtedly there are several new Honeycrisps out there just waiting to be discovered, and probably never will be, but you never know. Thoreau was a big apple head back in the day, and he also wrote a great essay about wild apples, and he had a quote sort of speaking to this like Dickensian one in a million promise that every apple seed holds in it. So he said that every wild apple shrub excites our expectation, thus somewhat as every wild child, it is perhaps a prince in disguise. Who knows? But this chance wild fruit, planted by a cow or a bird on some remote and rocky hillside where it is as yet unobserved by man, may be the choicest of all its kind, and foreign potentates shall hear of it, and royal societies seek to propagate it. Well, that's happened, and because people have paid close attention to apples, and because they're so long-lived, and they kind of have a lot of character, we've been able to trace some of these princes in disguise through history from the time we know where the first tree came from. Rhode Island Greening, Newport, Rhode Island, 1640, still with us today. Baldwin, one of the most famous apples America ever produced, born outside of Boston in the 1740s and became such an important apple worldwide by 1900 that they actually erected a monument to Baldwin. It's right in the Boston suburbs today, right? Not far out of town. You can go. There's a little park on a street corner. All about this is the spot where the very first Baldwin tree came into being. So apples were a big deal. Aesopus Spitzenberg, which the old apple books have raved about for 200 years, another one that's still with us. Not long after Johnny Appleseed's day, the USDA estimated that there were over 7,000 varieties of apple in the U.S. And, of course, I've been talking about fresh apples for a little while here, but quite a few of those apples had one purpose and one purpose only. They were for this guy. This is what moonshiners used to look like. There were a lot of cider apples out there that were for nothing but cider, because when you're making a good hard cider, you don't want to use fresh dessert apples because you ferment away the sweetness, turn into alcohol, and the flavors that are left in a dessert apple are sometimes kind of weird to drink dry. They almost taste like perfume sometimes. So the cider apples were almost more like red wine grapes. They had a lot of tannins in them and other things that would turn into really interesting flavors and mouthfeel when you made them into alcohol. So this was a big business back in the day, and we tend to think of it as all, you know, like moonshiners and kind of backwoods stuff, but it was like the wine industry in Europe. It was very formal, and it was considered high-end. There was an apple called the Harrison that Newark was famous for. The very first important apple book in the U.S. in 1817 referred to the Harrison as the most celebrated of the cider apples of Newark. I know that sounds weird to our ears. The most it sounds like, you know, like the most celebrated of the Republicans of Marin County or something. But Newark, back in the day, was first famous for its cider. It was called Newark Champagne. It was supposed to be competitive with champagne in terms of quality, and sold for big bucks. You can still find the old bottles out there today of what was Newark Harrison cider. And if you look in the bottle, it'll say Harrison Sparkling Newark Cider. And not only did it compete with champagne, but it started being passed off as champagne, which was incredibly expensive to bring over. And it was kind of a scam, and people started referring to it as champagne. And that wasn't the end for Newark cider in particular, but that whole world went kablooey not long after that, because the temperance movement got started, and Carrie Nation started taking her hatchet to bars and apple trees, and suddenly it became very uncool to be growing a type of apple that was only good for turning into alcohol. And we really lost most of our cider varieties and lost the whole tradition of drinking it. And so I sort of thought of this as a thought experiment for what that's like. Imagine that it happened with wine instead of cider. Imagine that we were the heirs of this culture that had revered the grape and had created a really sophisticated civilization around making fine wine, and passed it on through the ages down to us. But then say that whole world went away, like really went away, where it was no longer part of our culture whatsoever, where it had just been considered debauchery, right? So people got rid of it. It was not acceptable to have wine be a part of your life anymore. And maybe you would see a few remnants of that civilization here and there, where you'd you'd see some old vines, and people would say, like, oh, yeah, that's because people used to drink wine. But imagine it was that far gone, because that's how far gone cider was. Grapes, what if grapes just became kids' play? That's what apples became. That's what happened to the cider end of things. But what happened to the rest of the apples, to dessert apples, was, in a way, almost even worse. And what happened was industrialization. That whole era of farmers kind of being breeders and cultivating these cool old varieties went away. People stopped having self-sufficient farms. They started getting their apples from the store, and the store did not want to deal with tons of different apples coming from different places. They wanted one apple that they could stock everywhere that would last for months and months and months in storage. And what did they come up with? The enemy of our story, the bad guy. The evil red empire took over, and by the 60s, 75% of the apples grown in America were Red Delicious, and we all know what they tasted like. They were sold because they were bright red, and people bought them. People consistently bought the redder apple over the better-tasting apple, so the growers gave us what we wanted or what it looked like we wanted. I think that's very sad. Why? Because, well, I've been arguing for diversity, and I tried to think of what's a good way to think about what the loss of diversity brings. Because it's kind of, you can get by without a lot of different apples, but it's better with a lot of different apples. Think about Shakespeare. We could probably get by if we just had three plays of Shakespeare's that had come down to us. King Lear, Hamlet, and, you know, a light comedy called Honeycrisp or something. But isn't it nice that we have 37 different plays of Shakespeare's?
You're listening to food writer Rowan Jacobson, whose book is Apples of Uncommon Character, on Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
Even better, think about dogs. We could probably get by with three dogs, too, right? If you've got, like, a Great Dane, a Border Collie, and a toy poodle, then everybody gets something pretty close to what they want. It might not be exactly what would be the best one for you, but everybody's covered. But thank goodness there's a lot of Shar Pei's and Australian sheepdogs out there, you know? Thank goodness there's a type of dog that's just right for everybody. And hopefully there are going to be a lot more apples out there easily accessed. And that's happening now because apples are extremely patient, long-lived beings. It's nothing for an apple tree to go 100 years. It'll even go 200 years, just kind of like waiting for us to come to our senses and turn around. So there are still apple trees out there from that early era, from the early 1800s, of varieties that have been lost to us or nearly lost. And all you need to do is find one of those trees and take a few shoots, and you can graft those shoots and bring that variety back into commercial circulation. And that's happened. There's a lot of apple collectors out there. There's actually some people right in this room who are a part of that, who have all these apples available, apples that are unlike any of the ones we tend to taste in grocery stores. And stores are starting to come around and be willing to work with these apples. So it's a pretty exciting time. So what this means is that as heirlooms now have this new the renaissance that's going on, we're going to start seeing apples so much better than what we've seen before for certain things. All the apples you tend to see out there in a store are dessert, what's called in the industry dessert apples. They're meant for eating fresh. There isn't a single apple out there, maybe you could, with the exception of Granny Smith, that's intended to be a baking specialist. But back in the day, there were apples that were baking specialists. You wouldn't want to eat them fresh, but they had a firmness to them and acidity and flavor that made pies better than anything we see today with the fruit we have to work with. So there are some old varieties. Somebody today out there mentioned Belle de Boskoop, an incredible strudel apple from Holland that is turning up more and more at farmers markets. We're going to see some baked apples and pies that are truly phenomenal. Cider, too, is cool again. Cider is so acceptable that, for instance, the Hudson Valley has seized on it as a way to save their orchard culture that they still have because they haven't been able to compete on the commodity market, but they're going hard into hard cider. And we don't know what is going to happen with cider right now. The whole cider world is kind of in the trajectory that the craft beer world was 20 years ago. It's following that same path straight up, like really exploding lately. So it's a pretty exciting time to pay attention to cider because it's wide open. Because we lost that tradition, there are no rules. And so everyone is all over the place trying barrel-aged ciders, flavored ciders, and ice ciders, canned sort of English draft-style ciders, cider aperitifs that are almost more like a vermouth. We don't know what's going to end up being the right cider. There's not going to be a right cider. It's going to be everything. Sweet, dry. And that's I haven't seen a brand new beverage come into being like that. Not brand new, but brand new to us. Also, we don't know what the right apples are going to be for it. This is a pretty exciting experiment. That Harrison apple that I mentioned was not quite lost. We thought it was gone. And then a fruit collector guy in the 1980s found one old tree in New Jersey, grafted it, gave the saplings and the scion wood to a few people, and now the first commercial crops of Harrison in probably 120 years are just coming into fruition. A few people are getting Harrison fruit. Like, no one even knew what the fruit would be like. So it's almost as if we lost Pinot Noir. Pinot Noir disappeared from our culture, and then somebody found one and started growing it, and you get to taste the wine for the first time. So look for Harrison ciders in maybe 2 years. The Pippin is alive and well, not just here, but there's a big nonprofit, well, not a big, a very tiny nonprofit, who's got a big plan to bring the Pippin back and make it the official apple of New York City. So there are young Pippin trees planted all over New York City now, back to its roots, and back to Castle Hill, where Thomas Walker brought it in the 1750s. There's a new cidery growing Pippins and making Pippin cider right where his plantation was. So yeah, my point is that we're in the second age of the apple, and it's going to be a very exciting thing to watch, and I hope you all will have a seat at the table and enjoy it. Thanks for listening.
Thank you so much. I know we all have questions, and then if you raise your hand, I'll come to you.
Can you graft multiple apple types onto the same tree so that, say, you have four types growing on one tree?
Yeah, and actually all the old farmsteads used to have that. It was called a family tree. And usually it would be right in the front yard. Every branch would be a different variety. And you'll see some of these collectors, they do that today. It looks crazy, you know, like the bottom of the tree will be red apples, and then you'll get a stripe of yellow apples and then green apples on top. It's really fun to do that, actually. I've done some of that in my house.
So you said that all apple trees are from graft, not from seeds? All the apples?
Yeah, isn't that a shocker? Every Gravenstein on Earth is a clone of that first Gravenstein that was found somewhere in Denmark in the 1600s.
So if we take the seeds from our apples, it's a whole new, we're going to get a whole new variety if it even grows.
And then you get to name it after yourself.
Cool.
Seriously.
So what kind of apple would you recommend for apple cake?
Well, do you want firm apples in your apple cake, or do you want tender apples? I think for, I don't know. Pie definitely for, although for, to make a great apple pie, you really want like five different kinds of apples. That's the key to a good pie, is some firm, some sweet, some tart, one that's a little more gluey to kind of glue everything together.
Like, which one's gluey?
Well, Bramley's seedling. Somebody's growing Bramley's seedling out there, right? Hidden Star Orchard, they're growing Bramley's seedling, which is the pie apple in England. But like the French like really firm apple in their pie like we do. But in England, Bramley's seedling is a really gluey apple that it kind of breaks down and makes more of a paste. So when Johann's Bramley's seedlings are ready in a couple of years, I'd grab one of those. But Macintosh actually breaks down pretty well too.
So when I was a kid in Pennsylvania, we used to go out to the country and get Golden Delicious apples. And they were picked fresh off the tree and they were wonderful. I've not seen those apples anymore. What happened?
Yeah, you nailed it. Golden Delicious, which is now one of those other apples we kind of make fun of, was considered one of the greatest apples that had ever been found. When it was considered so good, the nursery, this one farmer discovered it, showed it to a local nursery. They bought the apple off of him for $5,000 and a 900-foot plot of land around the apple, and they put up an electric cage around it so that nobody could steal, you know, could get a graft off of it, so they would have a monopoly on the Golden Delicious. And they did. They made $1 million off the apple. And it was really crisp. It was almost like the Honeycrisp of its day, beautiful kind of melony sweetness. Those apples were coming off of a tree in sunny places. And now almost all the Golden Delicious come from places that aren't quite that warm. It was a southern apple originally. It was West Virginia where it got started. And they pick them green now because they want them to last in storage. So it shouldn't look, a Golden Delicious should be really yellow, like bright yellow. And if it's bright yellow, actually I had a Golden Delicious yesterday in Sebastopol, California. That was the best apple I'd tasted in a long time. It was fully ripe, really crisp, straight off the tree. It was beautiful. And that's probably what you were getting back in the day. So farmers, I'd say like pick your own, and Farmer's Market Golden Delicious is going to be a lot better than the store Golden Delicious. Makes a big difference with that one.
If the apple propagation is mostly asexual, the grafting that you were talking about, why is it important then to have the bees be vibrant for that particular crop? I mean,
Because that's necessary for them to make the actual apple.
Thank you.
Like, if they don't get pollinated, they won't produce fruit. So the fruit, they produce the same fruit, type of fruit every year, but the seeds inside would not make that fruit, because they have a different genetic mix. But the mother tree has, you know, she always makes the same fruit.
Please join me in thanking Rowan Jacobson.
You've been listening to food writer Rowan Jacobson, who presented his book Apples of Uncommon Character at one of the Community Foodways programs at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Now, for the second half of the hour, our guest is farmer, community organizer, and environmental justice advocate Kristen Leach from Namu Farm. She's joined in conversation by writer and food activist Shakira Simley. And now, join Thuy Tran on stage at the JCCSF as she introduces Kristen Leach and Shakira Simley.
Hello, everyone. My name is Thuy. I am the Associate Producer of Public Programs at the JCC. This event is a celebration of two holidays, Jewish Sukkot and Chuseok, the Korean Thanksgiving, both celebrations of the fall harvest and agriculture. They are both a time of great joy and gratitude. Sukkot also encourages us to embrace impermanence. To do this, we build actual sukkahs, or temporary huts, where we are encouraged to eat, sleep, and live life outside and under the stars. And it is especially poignant to reflect on impermanence while so many of us and our loved ones, friends, community members, farmers, winemakers, and others to the north are experiencing devastating loss of homes, businesses, community, and even lives. I know we've seen some tragedies these last few weeks, locally, nationally, and globally. I would like to acknowledge that everyone in this room has probably been affected in one way or another, and I want to thank you for choosing to be here with us tonight. In the Jewish tradition, we fill our sukkah, this impermanent dwelling, with the most precious things, dear friends, over a thoughtful meal, to show gratitude for the present. As we sit beneath the atrium sukkah, we want this space to be for you, to come together to share a meal, to share stories, and to share comfort and connection with a person next to you, across from you, or maybe if you're a hardcore introvert like me, sometimes I'm an introvert, you'll find your comfort and connection in a bowl of kimchi braised lamb, which you will have tonight. Ultimately, we hope you walk out with a bigger community than when you arrived. Tonight's program, Generation Seed, Growing a Cultural Legacy, asks the questions, how do you preserve culture? What does regenerative agriculture look like? When you eat dragon's tongue beans and perilla seeds, what hidden histories and migratory patterns are you consuming? Amazing human being, farmer and food justice advocate, Kristen Leach of Namu Farm, has been living with these questions and has made it her life's work to answer them. And we are all lucky enough to get to hear from her and learn more later tonight. I'd like to introduce our moderator for the evening. It is my honor to introduce Shakira Simley, who is a writer, yes, educator and community organizer in San Francisco. She has over a decade of experience working on food equity policy issues, national youth organizing, and labor unionization campaigns. She is a 2017 fellow for the Stone Barn Center for Food and Agriculture, former community director for Byright and his family of businesses in SF, and is the co-founder of Nourish Resist, a multiracial organizing collaborative dedicated to using food spaces, and people as tools for collective resistance. She received her MA from the University of Gastronomic Sciences via Fulbright Scholarship and was honored as one of Zagat's 30 Under 30. Welcome, Shakira.
Okay. Good evening, everyone. Hi. What's up? Okay. So let's start talking to our guest of honor, Kristen Leach.
Okay. So I have long been inspired by you and, of course, all the beautiful heirloom vegetables that I've had at NAMU that I know you grow. But I've also been inspired by you and all your organizing work in connection to community and seed cultivation and saving. So for those that are newbies in the room, if you can just tell us who you are, where you're from. Yes?
Okay, well, my name is Kristen, and I manage the NAMU farm in Sanol. I live in Oakland, and we grow predominantly heirloom East Asian herbs and vegetables, and we also do field trials for Kitazawa Seed Company, which turned 100 this year, and we grow commercial seed for them.
Great. And where are you from?
From Long Island.
Long Island! So we're talking about Generation Seed. So I was wondering if you could start us off by talking about why seed preservation is so important and why seed preservation is important for folks across the diaspora.
Why is seed preservation important? Only because it's like the blueprint for all of civilization, you know. There's okay. That. I think that right now the kind of grief that people are feeling and the terror that we're kind of witnessing. Seeds are just kind of this physical material resource that just works really as a counter-narrative to kind of the destruction and the violence that we're kind of seeing. And so we always kind of like go through the math of seeds when we have like especially kids on the farm, because it's kind of just this pure magic where it's like, oh, you take one seed and you put it in the ground and something grows and it gives you back like 100 times what you put into it. And I think just that alone, even though it seems esoteric, like is very profound to kind of like see day to day in terms of just something that's about abundance and generosity. And so I think just on a very personal level, to kind of just get to see something that is a truer story than the one we kind of like live in and invest in as like a kind of weird capitalist mythology. But then in terms of just like the basics of, you know, this series that Twi has kind of initiated here being about cultural foodways and preservation of culture, seed is something that's very overlooked at times in terms of just like where that comes from and who's curating that seed supply and how that industry has been consolidated over the past few decades. And I think that it leaves, like most things involving climate change, it will disproportionately impact people along the lines of race and class. It'll disproportionately impact people living in the global south. And so seed is just like a reflection of that. So for me as a Korean American, I felt very compelled to grow Korean varieties of vegetables. And through working with Kitazawa and kind of seeing what we had access to here, as amazing as that is, it still reflects kind of a situation that's not very empowering for farmers within Korea. It is actively dispossessing small farmers of their land and kind of any sort of thing revolving around the idea of sovereignty. And so to me, it felt very important to, think about how to address those things, I suppose.
Okay. You're not growing any type of seed. You're specifically focusing on Korean varietals. I want to know, what have you learned about yourself in growing those specific types of seeds? And what have you learned about your community in doing that as well?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can't totally convey all the things that I've learned on a deeply personal level and then in this kind of, in a collective sensibility for the type of community we've been able to build around the farm. I mean, I think to me when I started, I think as an adoptee and not growing up in Korean culture, there is this way that engaging with plants was like the way that I knew how to kind of explore my identity, my sense of place within Korean lineage. And so I know that in a lot of indigenous languages on this continent, like plant roughly translates to those who take care of us. And I feel like that has been my sense of things, is like growing plants really guided me towards like these connections with different people, or it felt resonant in a way that I could connect with others within Korean community. And I think in the Bay especially, that Korean community is so diverse, and it embraces and is very accessible for a lot of folks. That so I just feel very lucky in that regard.
You're listening to farmer, community organizer, and environmental justice advocate Kristen Leach from Namu Farm. She's joined in conversation by Shakira Simley on Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
But yeah, I sort of reverse engineered this kind of connection to culture as like an outsider in a lot of ways, and through learning about plants and not having a context to start with, I had to like ask questions. And being fairly introverted just in general, like it was good to kind of have the plants push me towards like needing to be curious in a way that made me talk to other humans and not just be alone on the farm.
Some pretty educational plants.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. And so I think, you know, like Dohi is our sort of resident shaman on the farm, so we're like extremely blessed in that regard. But when I heard that music at our first Chuseok and just thought, I was like, oh, if my plants can have like a heartbeat that sounds like the way Dohi plays this drum, then my farm is going to be really, really healthy. And through thinking about that music and what she explained to everybody, it's like it let farming be this kind of very vast and expansive conversation. It's like a conversation with these plants and like trying to figure out how to adapt them to different climate scenarios. It's a conversation with the past and it's a conversation with the future. So it really does feel like once you get into this weird seed brain, you're like everything is connected to seed, which makes for very boring happy hour conversation with me sometimes. But on the other hand, you know, if you want to go down a very weird biology wormhole, then
I'm ready.
Yeah, we're good. Yeah.
And one of our conversations before this event, we talked about, you know, the storytelling that happens through seed. So, you know, we're both folks of color, and even though we come from different parts of the diaspora, you know, my ancestors brought over Benny seeds to the South, which helped propel an entire industry and fed folks for hundreds of years, which is now mostly forgotten. And, you know, there's a lot lost in that when we don't mindfully cultivate and save. So I was wondering what sort of the stories, either lost or found, do you find yourself wanting to tell, or do you feel like it needs to be told through seed cultivation?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, our seed line that we curate through Kitazawa is called Second Generation Seeds because it both has this reference to lineage and for folks living in diaspora and immigration. And it also is a very nerdy seed reference because so we like saying second generation is also a nod to just like getting back to a biology that has any sort of reverence for the intelligence of plants and actually taking our cues from them. And so I think that I'm not like putting my ear to a seed and listening for the story, but I do think that there is a storytelling nature to that. And when I look at the history of some of the seeds that we've collected, some of the seeds that we've like made it our job to kind of reproduce and duplicate, like the story that they're telling is one of like centuries of farming that was like, you know, like didn't require a lot of capital. It didn't require a lot of off-the-farm inputs. It was designed around this nature of like things working in a symbiotic way that had a respect for like our place within a natural system. And so you see these seeds that can perform in like these types of very minimal systems, like subsistence farming systems, and the way that they behave, and it reflects like kind of this relationship. And then I think doing the field trials, like, we see a very different story unfold of, like, what hybrids look like when they perform and what the story they want to tell is, which is, like, a story that is hard to compete with or hard to argue against because farmers are so strapped. And so the type of homogeneous outcomes and the kind of control that it offers is very desirable for the way our food system is set up. Mm. But ultimately not one that's really designed for long-term success for farmers. And so with returning to heirlooms, it's kind of like trying to be like, what is the story we want to kind of tell to the future? And if these plants are so valuable, if they're just plants that we just know we could not live without, like, we brought all these love letters that people from our Nongwal program on the farm wrote to plants of the Korean diaspora. So we're like, oh, there's plants that are really significant to Koreans in Korea, and what does that look like, and why is there a significance for folks living in diaspora? And we were like, let's have you write a love letter to them, not just talking about their role in your memories, but talking to them as, like, this, you know, this presence in your life and thanking them for their struggles, because a lot of plants have been cultivated for, like, 10,000 years.
Wow.
And for some of those plants, that means that's 10,000 generations of something. And I think that that sort of give and take, like, felt very compelling to see the way people responded on the farm, because it was like the less you're able to objectify something and the more you're just, like, learn to love it, it, like, you can never put a dollar amount on that. And it, like, can't just be a commodity, you know? And so I think that that's maybe one of the parts of the story that we do want to tell on the farm.
Interesting. So even as a farmer, and we're using seed as voice, seed to tell a story, you're still working within the constraint, because sometimes those seeds or how they get to the United States is controlled by an industry with a specific agenda, and targeting certain countries and certain diasporas for success, not to preserve culture or heritage, but to turn a profit. So I was wondering if you could talk about kind of that tension and give us some insight into that and how that impacts your work as a farmer.
Yeah, I mean, Korea has been subject to the Green Revolution very similarly as most places around the globe. And so, you know, kind of starting with Japanese colonialism, where it sort of shifted agriculture to be more focused on export, leading into kind of the Korean War and Korea being, like, this top consumer of U.S. surplus during that time, like, being billed as, like, kind of emergency aid and then transitioning to being, like, a consumer for export. And then that relationship still exists to this day through a variety of, like, free trade agreements and trade liberalization over the past two decades. So when I went to Korea, there was the constraints that you speak about, like, felt so palpable, because we would travel with these seeds that we were kind of collecting and talking to other small farmers, and we got these, like, really beautiful soybeans, and I was just so struck by, like, how incredible this was, and soy being something that is so maligned, you know, because of the way that it takes its form currently in our society. And so we had these beans, and we'd show people, and it, like, everyone really responded. Oh, yeah, I remember those beans. Like, oh, do you want to grow them? And just by and large, people just felt like, no, you should take them because they'll be safer, and, like, you can protect them in the States. And it just felt so sad to just be like, oh, everyone, like, remembers these things, but the incentives for them were just, like, just not possible given the nature of, like, how much land is being lost in Korea, how much this kind of shift to just being undercut by foreign imports, how much labor is shifting to be in the industrial sector. So when you're looking at this kind of bigger landscape politically of, like, how land is treated and how people in Korea are being treated for the type of economic growth that it's had, yeah, I think that was the most surprising thing, was just that I even asked, like, oh, if we duplicate the seeds, do you want us to send them back? And they're like, no, like, just find a way to, like, keep them safe. And so it just, yeah, realizing that people felt that despondent and that that really reflects something that's probably all too commonplace at this point.
Despondent, but there's also a tiny bit of hope.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, definitely. I think it's interesting to them. Like, they were very struck by the notion of, like, some weird-looking Californian growing these seeds here. And but they made me show them my hands. They'd be like, okay, we're going to give you all these seeds. They're like, we trust you.
Yeah. Insure them.
Yeah.
So let's talk about that hope and that trust, because I think that those are two really important components of building a more resilient food system. And I would love for you to share, I mean, maybe today is a hard day to do that, but maybe sharing your ideas on what that resiliency could look like, given the increasingly palpable impacts of climate change.
Mm-hmm. Well, the great thing that's hopeful is that my farm has only been around for 6 years, but in those 6 years, we've seen like pretty remarkable shifts in terms of both like what it means to invest in soil and soil health in a regenerative way, and then also the adaptivity of seeds and plants. So we would do field trials and kind of stress things in this deliberate way to kind of, along these lines of heat and drought being the most compelling kind of factors for farmers in this region of California. So with those as our kind of metrics, we tried to just stress things. But we saw a pretty quick turnaround is the reality. Like, we would grow, like, let's say, 4 rows of something like eggplant, and just something that generally has like pretty moderate to high needs in terms of water and fertility. We would grow like 2 lines for just commercial production. We'd kind of give it everything that we thought it needed to get a good yield. And we'd grow the other 2 with like these deliberate stressors in terms of giving it a lot less of everything, depriving it of certain things, and then just watching kind of a population struggle and then trying to see like what was there in terms of like that hopefulness of the plant's like strength and own kind of innate resilience. But in only those 6 years, and some of these plants, it's even less, like we've been adapting those Korean crops for 4 years. And we just see like that investment when you are thinking about the long term kind of like makes sense a lot in the short term. And so I think that like when you ask like, oh, we should talk about resilience in some way, I was like, oh, trying to think about it. And yeah, in this moment, that seems really significant. But I think also the other part is like doing Nongwal on the farm. Like it made me realize like, oh, resilience and accountability, these are things we talk about. Like it's this like response to something when in actuality, it feels more like a muscle. We should just be like working kind of all the time. And the things that I see as being most resilient is because there's like this distinct investment, and it's not just about crisis management. It's just like these ways that people like really kind of dig their heels in and kind of commit to it. And so seeing kind of folks in the farm school that we did, just like this instant kind of relationship that got built over this pretty short period of time and the way people felt really accountable to one another, and really accountable to those plants was really amazing. Like you could sit there and just tell that it's like, yeah, people are getting this very personal experience, but it's translating so instantly to like that sense of collective buy-in. Like YC, who organized it, yeah, I don't think either of us necessarily knew that that would happen. It would just kind of gel together so quickly.
So, I mean, do what we can now, but plan for the future. Right?
Yeah, I would say so.
It's kind of like the saying, like, you know, we're doing things for 7 generations after us.
Yeah.
So keeping that in our mind's eye.
Yeah.
I have one more question to kind of also contextualize this conversation and talking about resilience in spaces. Jerry Brown signed a bill that certifies California as a sanctuary state, which is great, right? And a question that I've been having for other farmers and chefs and activists, you know, the concept of sanctuary can feel so elusive for folks of color, for queer and trans folks, for undocumented folks, because it's like sanctuary when and how. So I wanted to ask you, what is the responsibility of folks in food and agriculture for creating sanctuary? And what does that look like?
for people, not just for seeds, but for people.
Mm-hmm. I'm like, well, I'm going to answer your very gigantic question with maybe a really gigantic answer.
Save us from ourselves.
Yeah.
Please, Kristen. Tell us everything.
I think it's the same thing. It's like this need to respond with sanctuary just points the finger at just like a much bigger problem that we've like let ourselves kind of live within, semi-acknowledge, but not really like asking us to inherently change the type of system that we're living in. Mm. And I think that when the history of this country is founded on theft and everything that has followed is based on exploitation, then the notion of sanctuary feels elusive, because unless we're really willing to like dismantle that before we move on, then I think it's going to just have that sense of putting out fires constantly. Mm. So when we ask about sanctuary, it's about like what type of thing in the wake of all of this sort of, you know, terror would we kind of design from the start? When we talk about like seeds as a blueprint, it's like we look at the system we're living in, and you can't kind of just like tweak these little pieces when it's just been designed completely counter to what we think we're working towards. So we can't expect a system that like only exists and thrives with this type of violence to like work against its own interest. And so
an erasure.
Yeah. Right. And so it's like, maybe that sounds like I was like in an anarchist teenage collective. I was like, maybe we're getting verging on this territory of starting to sound like an anarchist teenager from Long Island. But, you know, it is what it is, I suppose.
She sounds awesome.
Yeah.
Great. I just want to ask you all to join me in thanking Kristen for nourishing us and feeding us this evening.
Bina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and KALW. For more information about programs at the JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. Today's program featured two topics from the JCCSF Foodways series. In the first half of the hour, our guest was James Beard Award-winning writer Rowan Jacobson, who writes on food and the environment and the intersection of the two. He presented from his book, Apples of Uncommon Character. And in the second half of the hour, our guest was farmer, community organizer, and environmental justice advocate Kristen Leach from Namu Farm. She was joined in conversation by writer and food activist Shakira Simley. The recording engineers at the JCCSF are Ben Bernardi, Brandon Battaglia, Dan Folds, Alex Espalet, and Lincoln Andrews. David Kwan edits and produces the program, and Matt Martin is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Rashanim Trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. Bina is available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. I'm Jordan Abel. Thanks for listening.